Welcome to What's Left, a weekly political discussion challenging the mainstream left. My name's Andy Libson, and again, we're joined by Kenny Zepeda, standing in for Eduardo, we're going to do something a little different this time.
All right.
Can you describe, tell us what it is?
Yeah, we're going to comment to Trump's address of the nation yesterday regarding the Iran strikes and the response.
Yeah, so we had actually really hoped to do this thing around France and the French, the yellow vest there. Eduardo still has not been able to get himself free for doing a video. He'll be returning next week, and we're going to talk about his trip in France. Me and Kenny were talking about this, and we had actually thought about reacting to some of the stuff said by Michael Pompeo.
Yeah.
But then Trump did the speech after a more developments since the killing of General Soleimani. So we're going to do like a reaction video.
Yeah.
You know? And we're going to do it for Trump's address to the country. We should get started.
All right, let's do it.
Okay.
And here we have President of the United States to address the nation and the world.
So, first thing I would say is this is a very unusual look for a president who's addressing the country. As you can see, he's got some of his major cabinet people. Pompeo's there, Pence, the other dude, Esper, he's the Secretary of Defense.
Okay.
And then he's got all his Joint Chiefs of Staff or generals behind
generals,
him.
Generals, yeah.
Yeah. So this is more the look of what we commonly look at as kind of third-rate dictatorships who address their people.
Kim Jong-un, and all the people we accuse of being thugs.
Right. And I do think, I mean, here's my question is, why this look? Why is he putting this whole militaristic thing?
Show of power. Display of power. And, I don't know, it's technically the people that equivalent to Soleimani in Iran, I think.
Yeah. So the question for me is this a look for the U.S. public, or is this a look for the United States' enemies, which
It's for the world.
It's for the world, yeah. And I believe that this look right here, it's for the public. It's to make him look strong and tough. And there's an election going on here. But the biggest message that's being sent here is to Iran, to Russia, to China, which is we are serious and don't F with us because we plan on doing more of these kinds of things we've just done. There are things that have happened since, obviously, the killing of Soleimani, which we'll talk about. Namely, particularly the counterattack by Iran with the missile strikes.
That didn't kill anybody.
Didn't kill anybody. But I also believe that plane, few hours later, the plane went down in Iran. It was a Ukrainian airplane.
It was heading to Ukraine.
Right.
With Canadian and Iranian.
Mostly Iranian people. Yeah. But it had people from Canada, probably people from the Ukraine. And it went down hours after that. And initially, everyone said it was nothing.
Yeah. It took a day or so until anyone reacted. Right. And today, actually, what's his name? Trudeau responded, very emphatically that, they will get to the bottom of this because, the Canadian citizens.
Yeah, and I'll have more to say this, but I believe the U.S. has actually shot down Iranian planes before.
Yeah.
They shot it down in 1988, in the middle of the end of the Iraq-Iran war when the U.S. is siding with Iraq. They killed a bunch of civilians. 66 kids were killed. I believe this was a message sent by the United States to Iran. That's my belief. And there's been talk of whether it was a Russian missile.
So you're saying the U.S. took this down?
Yes.
Okay. Because what I've heard, obviously it's materializing.
Yeah.
The I guess the mainstream talking points is that Iran might have shot it down themselves by accident.
Right.
Because they're not very good at being military, that's the picture that is being painted.
I believe, I definitely know it wasn't a mechanical accident, which is what was put out at first. And Iran's basically saying, oh, no, this is not terrorism or anything like that. That's actually true. But I don't think I'll say more about this, but this is an indication. I believe the United States had a hand in this thing.
Why do you think then Iran wouldn't come out right away and point out at the U.S.?
Because if Iran admits that that they know the United States took down their plane and they don't do anything, then already in Iran there's talk about whether the response they gave is strong enough.
Yeah.
So if they admit that this happened, because I just think the U.S. made a straight gangster move and basically said, you just shot things at us, we're taking down your planes.
What do you make of Iran missing, you know, or there is no casualties to Iran's response? What do you make of that?
I mean, they destroyed some stuff. Iran is claiming deaths. I don't know what to make of it. Mm-hmm. And I would, by and large, say, I don't know what to make of whether that means Iran is not able to really strike where mm-hmm. it wants to go, or it's trying to send a message.
An empty swing of sorts? Like, yeah.
I can't tell whether it was an attempt at an empty swing, or they tried to make a strong swing and it was empty.
Yeah.
Either way, I believe that the United States responded immediately. That is my belief. And, you know, in the same way that, what did you find out?
Today? Oh yeah, I was sitting here, I was laughing at a headline on BBC News where Epstein, you know, the big Democratic donor that
yes.
was...
The dude who had it on everyone, had it on Clinton, had it on Prince George or whatever, had it on all sorts of politicians that they were pedophiles and, you know,
he himself was
sexual
predators. A known sex trafficker, basically.
Yes.
He was found guilty and given an unprecedented deal.
Yeah.
But yeah, so today the prosecutors in the case said that a technical error erased the CCTV footage in the jail, and that they had the wrong footage from the wrong jail.
Right.
And you said earlier, you know, that this is a person with a high profile, you know, and on Suicide Watch, and they fumbled, and there's all these mysterious things, you know, that don't add up, that is comical at this point, I think.
Right. So anyway,
we're
getting far afield of our reaction
yeah.
here, but I wouldn't put anything past the United States, and I believe that they had a hand in taking this plane down, and they were trying to send a message to Iran, maybe even a message to Ukraine, but it that's my belief. I don't believe it was the Iranians fumbling and doing it, and I don't believe that the Russians did it, which is another claim that's being made, that the Russians did this to send a message to Ukraine or something. But the message that was initially put out about this plane going down was it was mechanical error, and that's already unraveling. Mm-hmm. So this is very suspicious. But either way, let's get back to this. Yeah.
As long as I'm president of the United States, Iran will never be allowed to have a nuclear weapon.
Right away, you know, I think, as long as I am president. So I think he's linking it to his election campaign here.
Yeah.
You know, patronizing, you know, posing the U.S. as the police of the world, you know, the heroes, you know, the good guys, whatever.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the action that Trump has taken is supposedly a different response than what Obama took, right, with the, mm-hmm. the nuclear deal. Trump accuses the ruling class, the previous regime within the ruling class, of appeasing Iran and saying, that wasn't working towards keeping it from having nuclear weapons. I'm the person who knows how to do this, and I punch hard, and this is how we're doing it. Trump got out of the Iran deal, and now he's taken down one of their generals in Iraq. But more than this, I mean, we can talk more about strategies here, here's what's to say, is the reason that Iran has to pursue a nuclear weapon is because there's lots of reasons, but the minute the U.S. went into Iraq in 2003, everyone knew that that meant North Korea and Iran had to have a nuclear weapon, because the only way you could defend yourself when you have an aggressive, not just an adversary, but an aggressive, essentially a crazed dog at your door, which is the United States, then, and one that's extremely vicious and has all sorts of weapons. The only way Iran can defend itself is to get a nuclear weapon.
Yeah.
It's not going to defend itself on the basis of conventional weapons. Iran is currently surrounded by about 70,000 U.S. soldiers, and that doesn't include private contractors and things mm-hmm. like that. All sorts of bases surrounding Iran. So the reason that Iran is pursuing gaining a nuclear weapon, Europe is claiming this, the United States is claiming this, is because Iran is the threat. Mm-hmm. That's got it completely inverted. The threat is the United States.
Yeah.
And it was the actions of the United States that not only destroyed this whole region, right, or further destroyed this whole region, which we'll get to probably later, it is the aggression of the United States that is responsible for all these countries wanting to get nuclear weapons to defend themselves.
Escalation,
The United States, through its own violence, is ensuring that any sensible country, anybody who has their head on straight, is going to get a nuclear weapon to defend themselves. The only reason Gaddafi's dead right now is because he didn't get himself a nuclear weapon in his country.
Yeah.
And so Clinton, before they could do it, Clinton takes him out, and Obama. So don't get it twisted here, folks. The violence that is the reason that Iran is getting a nuclear weapon is it's only a line of defense if it wants to survive as a country.
And again, you mentioned North Korea, the same thing. You know, that region is the most militarized zone in the world, right?
Right.
The border of North and South Korea.
Right. With U.S. soldiers all over it. You know, yes. As well, yeah. So, but he's coming out and making a big play about it.
Big statement right away.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, that's it.
Good morning. I'm pleased to inform you the American people should be extremely grateful and happy.
Do you notice how he's breathing hard?
Yeah.
What do you make of that?
I don't know. He's old.
Okay.
No, he's nervous. I mean, he must be. Yeah. You know, it's a big moment.
Yeah.
I mean, I do think I've seen this before. We'll talk about it. But
yeah.
I think he is trying to look presidential, which is something, you know, a lot of liberal Democrats want from their president.
Yeah.
Because that's, you know, that's one of the biggest, like, character comparisons between him and Obama.
Yeah.
That Obama was presidential and he wasn't. And so I think we'll see more of that.
Yeah. I noticed he fumbled out a bunch of words during
this
thing.
Yeah.
And he's breathing hard. He seems extremely nervous. And I don't know what to make of it other than this is a huge moment in the world, and this clown, this character is caught in the center of it. And he's got to do what he's got to do.
Yeah.
No Americans were harmed in last night's attack by the Iranian regime. We suffered no casualties. All of our soldiers are safe, and only minimal damage was sustained at our military bases. Our great American forces are prepared for anything.
Sorry to stop it so often. Yeah, I mean, here's what I will say. I don't know about the reality of if anybody got harmed in terms of this, mm-hmm. but I will say that I'm a school teacher, and I can tell you that a lot of kids came to school wondering about World War III.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So the idea that no Americans are harmed by this, right? He's only talking about people, the 70,000 troops that are ringing Iran, right? But I can tell you that people are extremely distressed by what took place here. And his tone deafness and the U.S. ruling class's tone deafness to this is, I don't know what to say, other than people are being harmed by this.
No, I mean, you mentioned school kids, coworkers, you know, people are talking, my family, they're asking questions and concerns and, you know, even if it's light talk, they're talking about, oh, like, would we be safe in our countries, you know, like a lot of immigrant people?
But
definitely anxiety from this.
Iran appears to be standing down, which is a good thing for all parties concerned and a very good thing for the world.
Why do you think he's saying Iran? I have my notion, but why do you think he's saying Iran appears to be standing down? Because here's my belief on it, so I just want to see, what do you make of that?
That they're not, I mean, it seems like he's claiming that they that it's worked. Whatever the U.S. did worked, that the Iran is rethinking, you know, acting more normal, I guess, putting things in balance, you know.
And this is going to come back to why I think the U.S. had a hand in taking down that jetliner. Because there's no way that literally, this is still less than 24 hours after Iran sent the first salvo of missiles across and attacked. And maybe there's back-channel diplomacy that's going on, although I think the minute they killed Soleimani, I do think they eliminated really the possibility for any back-channel diplomacy, at least for the time being, until things cool off. One of the reasons why I think the U.S. had a hand in that is I think they wanted to see what Iran was going to do when they took down one of their jetliners in their country. And when they saw that Iran basically said it wasn't it was an accident, it was a mechanical failure, or when they saw that Iran was not going to basically, accuse the United States of what I believe they had a hand in doing, then I think that tells them they're ready to basically not escalate.
Iran is?
Yes. That's how, again, because I don't understand where the evidence is for that, based on the first volley of missiles that come, why you make your statement and said they're ready to settle.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I still have a hard time. Like, I don't know
what
the chips are going to fall in terms of the airplane, but I still don't see why Iran wouldn't use that to their benefit, you know, to expose the U.S. to the world, you know, and maybe even excuse any future moves of their own.
Because if they accuse the United States of doing this and reveal that to their own public, mm-hmm. that they know that the United
they
States
have
has
to
done that,
respond.
Then they have to respond. Then this missile response that they just gave, it's still not close to what people would expect in Iran.
So you're saying then that Iran is biting the bullet, basically, or the bigger brand, and they're if there is such a thing, they're being the bigger country, you know, like...
No, they got shock and awed into shutting the fuck up.
They're being cowed into...
Yes.
Okay.
That's my belief, is the United States said, look, we can shoot down one of your goddamn planes anytime we want, which I think is the situation the United States is right now in their country with special forces and things like mm-hmm. that. That's my belief.
Okay.
And so, no, Iran's not being big about this. Iran just got cowed into it. And the reason I say that is, why would you not say... How would Trump know that volley that just went was the end of it? How does he know that?
Mm-hmm.
Unless the U.S. did something and there has been no Iranian response. So that's my reason.
Okay.
And that's why I believe that this plane is the key to understanding what Trump is talking about.
All right.
So, more conspiracy theories from me. But didn't hang himself.
Of course not. I'm still just, yeah.
Yeah.
No American or Iraqi lives were lost because of the precautions taken, the dispersal of forces, and an early warning system that worked very well. I salute the incredible skill and courage of America's men and women in uniform. For far too long, all the way back to 1979, to be exact, nations have tolerated Iran's destructive and destabilizing behavior in the Middle East and beyond.
Now, why is he mentioning 1979? The Iranian Revolution.
Okay.
And why was there an Iranian Revolution?
Because the U.S. had imposed
a... Put a puppet Shah in there for 30 years. Why is the puppet Shah in Iran?
Because they tried to privatize...
Killed the president who used to be... The Iranians in the 50s had... The guy named Mossadegh had elected a president.
Mm-hmm.
Who would try to nationalize their oil. This is back in the 50s. They killed that guy. All right? They killed that guy like they killed Soleimani. All right? And so then they put their own guy in the Shah. And the Shah was a dictator. And the Iranians got sick of it. And eventually they took down... They went after the U.S. embassy, got them out, and took down the Shah in a revolution. That revolution was them taking their country back.
Yeah.
This is what Trump is so pissed about. This is what the U.S. ruling class is so pissed about. This is what they wanted to teach him a lesson about by killing Soleimani and by which is, how dare you resist us? How dare you try to have your own country? So they have never gotten over the idea that Iran actually tried to get their country back.
Yeah.
And they did so through a revolution. So understand that while we will be talking about 2003, the war in Iraq, as a major part that this guy doesn't want to talk about, no one wants to talk about in terms of the violence in the region, this goes way back further than this. We're talking 40, 50, 60, 70, and everyone says, oh, it's history.
I mean,
no, this is living history.
Iran was one of the first instances post-World War II, right, that the U.S. Removed that, you know, a democratically elected...
Mossadegh,
yeah.
Is his name.
Yeah. And then that they followed in Guatemala, and then they followed a bunch of... they followed the same model in Latin America and in the world,
you know,
of overthrowing democratically elected governments, and they impose dictators. Or they prefer dictators. It's easier to do business with them.
That's
because
correct.
They don't have to deal with the mess of a democracy.
Because the people you're looking at right now, if you look at... These are thugs. These are gangsters. But these are Republican gangsters.
Yeah.
All right? And before, just a few years ago, there used to be Democratic gangsters in the front of here.
Yeah.
They didn't have the same look. They wouldn't necessarily do the same show. But you could put Obama's face right there, and you'd have the same cast of characters back there. So again, don't get it twisted. This is just the Republican face of the U.S. military dog.
As a matter of fact, I think if you go back and look at, the moment Obama announced in May of... whatever year, the killing of Osama bin Laden.
That's correct.
And it's very similar.
That's exactly right.
You know, and they hit a lot of the same points, you know, yes. American exceptionalism, police of the world. So like you said, this is the Republican gangsters, Democrat gangsters had their light.
Right.
And now they're trying to, you know, take these guys out because they're in trouble.
Yeah, and I think a lot is made over, oh, look what Obama was doing when he was trying to, like, pay off Iran to not have nuclear weapons and that. But let's be clear, what was going on during that time? This is the U.S. ruling class. The U.S. ruling class needed Iran and Soleimani to fight ISIS. This is what they often talk about. So that was that period where they were trying to work with Iran to crush a common foe. Well, here's what you get for working with the United States. The minute you're no longer needed, the minute ISIS is out of the picture, we're going to smash you in the face.
The Kurds face that same,
exactly,
you know, truth about dealing with the U.S.
Right.
You know, and in reality, you can't trust the U.S.
I mean, and so to understand this, folks, the only reason we're seeing these policy changes, unfortunately, it has nothing to do with an anti-war movement here at home.
No.
None of these policy changes have anything to do with us resisting our own ruling class because we're suckers, because we're either Republicans or Democrats these days. And we think that's the only game in town. And that includes people who are going for Bernie Sanders. They're trying to win you to thinking the Democratic Party can be taken over. All they're trying to do is to get you to be anti-war within that pro-war party. But anyway, so just you don't believe that there was a nicer U.S. Ruling class or nicer U.S. imperialism before. They were biding their time with people like Soleimani. All the Democrats are in agreement with this guy getting killed.
No.
Whether it should have been done exactly this way, that's as much as they disagree with. They hope it works.
And, you know, and in fact, like talking around or having conversations with some, you know, Democrat leading people, the first soundbite that I hear is, he did not even consult Congress. And I'm like, baffled because he doesn't have to, you know, the rules are changed and even then they'll change. I mean, they have to.
Right. Right.
You know?
And Trump cited the authorization for the use of military force as part of that. And there have been Democrats who are saying, oh, you can't do that. All right. And there have been some Republicans who are critical of him. Supposedly this behind the behind the doors briefing that they got about the thing was like very there was very little information. The people who've been critical of it, and this, I'm not talking about the Democrats, people like Rand Paul and those other Republican guy who came out, they were like, they came out of there deciding to go along with the Democrats around trying to so-called restrain Trump on Iran. But largely on the basis of that briefing had no information. And Ron Paul basically said the information we got by these chiefs was no different than what you get in the news.
Yeah.
So they got nothing. And all this stuff they say about Soleimani being this and Soleimani being that and he was about to do this, I think there's no reason to believe anything other than a complete lie.
Because
that's the record for the intelligence community, is lying.
Yeah.
They have a seemingly 100% track record for lying. So when will they tell the truth?
Yeah, I mean, it's not even like an opinion. These are facts that you can look at the classified documents of, you know, they have a long history. I mean, Iraq, right?
Yes.
I mean,
and even the Afghanistan papers coming out and saying, lying again. They're lying about everything,
You know, and there's even things coming about the Arab Spring, right? And, you know, the role the U.S. had. And so, yeah.
Yeah.
Those days are over. Iran has been the leading sponsor of terrorism and their pursuit of nuclear weapons threatens the civilized world. We will never let that happen.
Yeah, this kind of brings me back to when we were watching Pompeo talk about Iran behaving as a normal country.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, civilized versus uncivilized and, you know, the U.S. Patronizing basically everyone else and, you know, into behaving the way that they're supposed to. I don't know if you have any thoughts.
The most uncivilized country on this planet is the United States.
Yeah.
They are the most abnormal, violent, crazed, sadistic ruling class on the planet. They're responsible for everything that's been happening here.
Yeah. I mean, if we look at just Iraq and Afghanistan, there are some estimates that since those wars started, at least 500,000 people, 500,000, at least 500,000 people have died as a result from those wars. And, you know, and so how much more civilized does that make this country?
And go back, not just to people like Obama and Trump and Bush, go back to Bill Clinton and the days of Madeleine Albright, when Leslie Stahl interviewed her and mm-hmm. asked her, it has been estimated that over 500,000 people, many of them women and elderly, I mean children and elderly, have been killed by the U.S. sanctions on Iraq. That kind of were between yeah. Iraq War I and Iraq War II. You know, Madeleine Albright's response was, no, that's not true. It hasn't been 500,000 people. Leslie Stahl asked her, has that been worth it? Mm-hmm. And Madeleine Albright basically said, yeah, we needed to do it. Yeah, you got to break a few eggs. She didn't say break a few eggs, but essentially, yeah. break a few eggs, 500,000 people have to get killed. These people are like absolutely vicious, maniacal, worse than any mullah ever out there that they say is so, worse than any ISIS, worse than any, you know, these. Who was the dude in Africa who it was on the YouTube all the time that they were saying was so vicious? Some dude, 2000. Anyway, all these people who they say are warlords in Africa, all of them are preschoolers in violence compared to the U.S. ruling class, who are like, they've graduated with honors on how to be the most vicious criminal ruling classes on the globe.
It's not just the bombings, the dronings, it's the sanctions, you know, that they want to impose regime change, something they don't even hide in their speeches. And so, yeah, they create hunger and they want, you know, people to be desperate and go hungry. Yeah, right. I mean, they had a while back last year, because of the inability of Iran to access financial markets, international right. financial markets, they couldn't pay for some shiploads of grains at the port. So, you know, they were just held there for a long time.
Right.
And, you know, that's a direct result of the sanctions, you know. And same thing in Venezuela, you know, yes, there are some, you know, people, you know, going hungry, but it's not just the Venezuelan government, you know, it's the U.S. by and large crippling the ability of these countries to make big transactions, yep. because you cannot do this in the black market, you know, to such big transactions.
Yep. Yeah. So, and where have the tin pot dictators and brutal military thugs of South America been trained?
School
of the Americas, which is not yeah. in South America. It's in Fort Benning, Georgia.
A lot of dictators actually went. Yeah, they came. They studied.
They
in
go
the
to
US,
school here
in the U.S. Yeah.
They go to school like, here to learn torture.
Somoza in Nicaragua. He graduated from West Point. You know, like
right. So, if this is what you're looking at here, you are looking at the biggest criminals, the biggest terrorists, lecturing the rest of the globe that they are terrorizing.
Yeah.
On being terrorists. And we are here as U.S. citizens consuming this crap.
Yeah.
Last week, we took decisive action to stop a ruthless terrorist from threatening American lives. At my direction, the United States military eliminated the world's top terrorist, Qasem Soleimani. As the head of the Quds Force, Soleimani was personally responsible for some of the absolutely worst atrocities. He trained terrorist armies, including Hezbollah, launching terrorist strikes against civilian targets. He fueled bloody civil wars all across the region. He viciously wounded and murdered thousands of U.S. troops, including the planting of roadside bombs that maim and dismember their victims. Soleimani directed the recent attacks on U.S. personnel in Iraq.
Should we continue and wait till he finishes that, or start here?
I mean, just a quick one that, yeah. you know, that, I mean, when he says all this, I'm like, are you talking about the U.S.?
Right.
You know, this is what the U.S. does everywhere, has done, and you know, dismembering and, you know, training, you know, terrorist groups, funding terrorist groups, you know, the U.S. obviously supported and created the Taliban, you know, when they were fighting the Russians, right?
Right.
So that's something, you know,
right.
I don't know if everyone knows that, but...
Right, and not just everywhere, but the U.S., it is the U.S. that is responsible for the violence, specifically in places like Syria, the civil war.
Yeah.
The U.S.'s policy has been regime change by essentially funding any elements that are trying to take down Assad.
Divide and conquer, right?
Right. Yeah. Right. And so they haven't been unwilling to come in and directly do it. That was what Obama was considering for a moment. But they've been made no bones about it. They've been willing to arm and fund mm-hmm. people in Syria. And so the reason hundreds of thousands of people have been killed in Syria is directly related to U.S. criminality of trying to fund a civil war to take down Barack Assad. Barack Assad.
No,
Bashir. Bashir Assad.
Bashir al-Assad.
I think.
They're from Syria, right?
Yes, yeah.
Bashir al-Assad, yeah.
Yeah, and so it's not Soleimani who's responsible for that. It's the United States who started that whole rainmaking going on. And all the violence in the region, from Afghanistan to Libya to Iraq, all of that has been initiated by the United States. Now, the West has a larger role in carving up the Middle East and doing divide and conquer. Britain has a big role in that. The United States has a hand in that. Russia has a hand. So the former Soviet Union has a hand in getting in there. But to be basically laying claim that this guy, Soleimani, is responsible for the things that the U.S. actually started, and that they actually built an alliance with Soleimani to try to fight ISIS. And some of the rise of ISIS, of what they call ISIS, is actually related to the munitions and arming of groups that the U.S. has been trying to arm in that region. It's complete hypocrisy. It's attempting to put onto this person who they've just bombed and killed, blame that person for everything that the United States has largely been responsible for. And Hezbollah. Hezbollah is a resistance movement to Israeli violence in the region. And one of the biggest claims to fame that Hezbollah can make is when Israel came after him, they actually pushed him back because they weren't just fighting back with rocks. The Palestinian people only had rocks. Hezbollah has weapons. And yes, they see alliances with Iran. It's a mistake. It's a mistake ultimately for any real liberation movement. And this is a bit of a mistake for the liberation movements of the Palestinian liberation movements or Middle Eastern liberation movements to think that there's some ruling class within the region that's going to defend you. There is no future in that. But I will say that Hezbollah probably got weapons from Iran to try to fight off Israel, and that's what they're going to do to defend themselves. They're a resistance movement, folks. And because they're a resistance movement, they are hated and excoriated by anybody, by any of these clowns who are trying to rule the world, because they dare to stand up against them. And Andy, believes that there are partial elements of ISIS that were constituted as part of a resistance movement within Iraq and Iran. Largely religious, and, you know, got all sorts of things I don't want to agree with, but a partial result of grassroots opposition to U.S. imperialism.
Of course, I mean, it goes to basics. I mean, if they come and destroy your home and your livelihood, and, you know, you have to make a living, you know, because some of these people did it out of conviction, joining ISIL, whatever.
Right.
Other people's for a paycheck, you know, out of fucking hate.
And other people did come in where the United States would back them and think they could get something.
Yeah.
Think you could use the United States to get something else against somebody else. This is the thing that the Kurds are finding.
Yeah.
Is you make a deal with the United States, it's just a matter of time before you get screwed. Yeah. Same with Soleimani. He found that out himself.
Yeah.
You know?
That badly wounded four service members and killed one American, and he orchestrated the violent assault on the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad. In recent days, he was planning new attacks on American targets, but we stopped him.
The only thing I'll say here is that what I think Trump is revealing here is that the United States was very upset with some of the things that they've been facing, with the downing of two drones without a response, the attack on Saudi Arabian oil fields, oil refineries, one of those, their attack on their embassy, again, 1979. That's where he started this. That was when the U.S. embassy in Iran was taken down. Yeah. They didn't like that. That does not look good. That's very bad optics. For if you're going to try to run the globe as the brutal dictatorship that the United States actually is as a global hegemon, you can't allow that to go without somebody taking a hit. And so what you're seeing in terms of what he's saying is he's trying to say, yes, we get it. We understand that we've looked weak in response to these things. And now this guy's taken down. So we got the last laugh. You know, so this is him attempting to say to the world, you didn't get over on us. We got over on you.
Soleimani's hands were drenched in both American and Iranian blood.
I have to say, first of all, the American soldiers that he's killing, how did they get there? Like, did he come over to North Carolina and kill some U.S. soldiers?
Yeah.
Did he come to San Francisco or where bases in the United States? Those people who are being killed, if you are going to believe that, and I do believe that Iran, China, Russia all had some kind of hand somewhere in there to try to mess with the United States while they're essentially occupying the entire region.
Yeah.
So these are occupying soldiers. We tell stories about what German soldiers did during World War II occupation of France, And we have movies about resistance forces that went and killed them and did that kind of thing. And then what do the German soldiers do? They line up the U.S. citizen, the various citizens, kill every one-tenth until you tell us who did it, right? And we say that they're the bad guys. The occupying Germans are the bad guys. Well, that's what the United States is right now. They're the bad guys in the region, and anybody who's taking them out is largely seen as a good guy. And that's how we understand that story. That's what resistance means, resistance to occupation. Now, is Soleimani, Soleimani's taking advantage of the fact, this is the same thing that the United States did when the Soviet Union went into Afghanistan, is basically said, you've got your hand in the cookie jar, that's what the United States did, so we're gonna fund the Taliban, to take you down, okay, and bloody you. And this is what happened in the United States. So these soldiers who are getting killed are occupying soldiers. They shouldn't be there.
Yeah.
And so if you don't want them killed, they gotta go. They gotta leave. Otherwise, really, the reality is if you want freedom in this world, then you should be supporting the defeat of U.S. soldiers anywhere they are, unless they're here in the United States, taking down the government. Everywhere else, they should be removed one way or another.
He should have been terminated long ago. By removing Soleimani, we have sent a powerful message to terrorists. If you value your own life, you will not threaten the lives of our people.
What do you think of that?
I think this is a message to everyone. A message to anyone that resists the U.S., North Korea, Russians, you know, anyone. You know, South America, you know.
Yep.
If you're not with us, you're against us, basically.
And we can get you anywhere you think you might be safe. We can get you anywhere, anytime, out of the sky, out of the blue.
Yeah.
Death from above.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I keep hearing like in a bunch of news outlets is that Soleimani dared to go openly to, you know, Iraq. And I'm like, wait, why? Is he supposed to be undercover?
Right.
You know, or is he, isn't he technically a functionary or, you know, of the state of Iran? You know, isn't he allowed to go anywhere? You know?
Right.
And it's just buying this whole thing, the mystique that he was a terrorist, you know, and that he should have been hiding.
Right. And where did this policy of we can kill you anytime we want to and get you without you knowing it, where does that really come from?
It's Obama, right?
That's Barack Obama, folks.
I mean,
he's taking a page from Barack Obama's playbook and now taking it and going after this guy. You know, they already did it with Gaddafi, right? And so this is a playbook by Barack Obama, who used the authorization for the use of military force as the justification for not needing to get congressional approval for what were essentially acts of war in all these different countries.
There's something I read recently where it's about drones and the drone strikes in Yemen. You know, there had only been like one or two by 2006, I think, something like that. But by the time Obama's first year, Yemen saw more strikes than all of Bush's administration. And so Obama really took that, embraced that, and then took off running with, you know, the whole drone program.
Yep.
And, you know, to me, like, it's changed the nature of war. Mm-hmm. You know, like, it's remote. It's not, you know, casualties are not, you know, being televised, you know, coming back to the U.S. like it was in Vietnam.
Yeah.
It's also privatized war, you know, because, you know, I don't know, but like a lot of the drone operations, you know, they are, you know, the drones take off, and that part is done by a private company. Then it's handed over to military, who, you know, kill people. Mm-hmm. Then the plane is handed back over to the private, you know, contractors to land the planes, you know, out of places like Colorado and other places in the U.S. Mm. This is the U.S. actually preparing for the war of the future, you know, with bigger reach anywhere in the world. And, you know, this is what, you know, I think Trump is making reference to. And, you know, also a message to China, right? Because China has a much bigger military in terms of numbers and potentially.
Kim Jong-un, obviously, immediately. But China, South Korea immediately, and China and Russia.
North Korea, sorry.
Yeah. Right.
And so it sends a message, right? That no matter how many forces you have, you know, we'll go after your top dogs and anywhere in the world if you dare stand up against us.
I don't think drones will fundamentally change what war is about, though, at the end of the day. War will still be about you have to cripple the economy of your opponent. That means nuclear weapons. That means tactical nuclear weapons. But
I think it
brings it into another terrain.
Yeah, I think it does. It changes.
But the idea that it's going to turn war into this surgical thing,
mm-hmm.
no. Okay. This stuff is going to draw everyone in ultimately, and we should have no illusions that these surgical strikes mean that war is going to be something where we only kill the people that quote need to be killed.
Yeah.
Wars are always about devastating the economies and the civilian, the ability of any given country to survive. It's no different than when war used to be like you got people into a castle and you had to starve them, mm-hmm. and you had to make them,
War by attrition.
That is still war, folks.
Yeah.
Even if you don't think it's happening that way, that is still war.
No.
And that's why I don't believe that these wars, this drone shit,
yeah.
turns war into something that's more surgical somehow.
Because ultimately, people that are corralled are going to have to fight back to survive.
That's correct.
I mean, if you're under threat, you will have to fight back.
Right.
And so it's a game of escalation.
Right. But in reality, what it does mean is for those people who are resisting this,
mm-hmm.
it's gonna look a lot more like what it looks like on Terminator 2 or Terminator 1, where the United States is Skynet,
yeah.
basically coming through with death from above, and they're all super soldiers and whatever, and it's everyone else trying to figure out how to survive in that context. So the bad guy in Terminator is essentially our country.
As we continue to evaluate options in response to Iranian aggression, the United States will immediately impose additional punishing economic sanctions on the Iranian regime. These powerful sanctions will remain until Iran changes its behavior.
I mean, the only thing I can say about this is they're already doing sanctions. They're trying to starve the country. I do think there's a regime change policy in place here.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it does seem to me that they are still looking to see if they can take down the Iranian government. At the very same time that I actually think they have built solidarity between Iranian people and their own government by doing this. So that's just one thing I thought as I was listening to that.
Yeah, I mean, I just wonder whether, you know, how would that regime change work? Like, you know, if there are some, factions of that ruling class, you know, that are willing to break off and take over, you know, because it's necessary, right? Like, it wouldn't just happen, you know, if no group willing to split.
The thing I was thinking, and I was kind of thinking about this, because how can they think they're going to do regime change when they've essentially created complete solidarity between the people of Iran and the government with these kind of actions? And I think what they're doing is trying to put the ruling class of Iran into a giant pressure cooker, a pressure mm-hmm. cooker, economic pressure cooker, a military pressure cooker, literally the threat of you being killed any time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they feel in the context of, they're going to say two things here, right? They're going to talk about, sanctions, but they're also, later he's going to talk about, you know, reaching out to mm-hmm. Iran. I think that they're going to look to create political fractures within the ruling class mm-hmm. of Iran over how to deal with the U.S., how to survive and deal with the United States. Which is, there's going to be people who want to appease the United States and people who want to go after the United States and in response to this. And they are fomenting those fractures by putting them under more and more pressure. That's what I started to think.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just thinking of, you know, last episode we talked about, the U.S. potentially just trying to light a match and walk away, right? Letting it blow up. I don't know if, you know...
I'm starting to rethink that.
Okay.
I've changed my mind. I mean, I think that this is the United States looking to stay.
Okay.
I mean, to me.
In recent months alone, Iran has seized ships in international waters, fired an unprovoked strike on Saudi Arabia, and shot down two U.S. drones. Iran's hostilities substantially increased after the foolish Iran nuclear deal was signed in 2013. And they were given $150 billion, not to mention $1.8 billion in cash. Instead of saying thank you to the United States, they chanted death to America. In fact, they chanted death to America the day the agreement was signed. Then Iran went on a terror spree, funded by the money from the deal, and created hell in Yemen, Syria, Lebanon, Afghanistan, and Iraq.
First off, I want to say something about the chance of death to America. There's immense anger in Iran and in the entire region towards the United States. People are right to chant that kind of stuff after the decades, and we're not just talking about 2 decades. We just talked about the 1950s when they killed their own their president. When you have American soldiers at your door, there's nothing else other than a chant than the death to America. If we had invading soldiers coming into our communities, that's what we'd be chanting. Death to whoever comes into our community. Yeah. What's that called when you go the other side? A collaborator. So the U.S. is occupying the region. So anybody with any sense on their shoulders is going to be chanting, is going to not wish them well, want to see an end to their presence there. And the only way that's going to happen is not because there's an anti-war movement in the United States that's going to pull them out of it. Mm-hmm. They're going to have to fight them. And they're going to have to kill U.S. soldiers in order to get the U.S. out of there. No. And so, again, the idea that that this guy is like saying, oh, look how ungrateful they are. There should be no gratitude. The U.S. has destroyed the region.
Of course. I mean, I don't know. You know, the whole death to America, like I've heard interviews, at least of people on the grounds. I mean, obviously you got to be critical, but, people are saying that, they're wishing death to America, the American state, the American, ruling class, because basically I've heard people, they don't have a problem with, citizens. They have a problem with our government.
And that needs to be a chant taken up by workers in this country. Death to the American state.
Yeah.
I mean, we have to take it down. We have to collapse that thing, bring it down, and form our own state. So understand that those are the terms of the battle now. And we don't get to decide that. That's what capitalism has imposed on us.
The missiles fired last night at us and our allies were paid for with the funds made available by the last administration. The regime also greatly tightened the reins on their own country.
I think that's stuff he's saying about the Iran deal. That seems like, there's a disagreement within the ruling class, I guess, but that seems like election stuff.
No. I forgot to mention that in the last pause, but yeah, it's bringing it back here, throwing, Obama basically without mentioning him, that administration paying, giving them money and, being a mad move. So yeah, it's back to election stuff. I mean, just one thought that, regardless, a lot of people, there was a question whether this was all related to the election year.
Right.
But
what's this? You mean?
The strike.
Oh, yeah.
The strike. And so, no, it's not, but obviously, him and his cronies and whatever he represents, they're not going to let go of an opportunity, right, to come up on top and look strong, and reassert American exceptionalism.
Right. But let's be also clear, there really isn't a disagreement within the ruling class about the need for the U.S. to act decisively in response to what has been these attacks and these embarrassments that they've faced. So there's, and again, the first thing any politician usually says is, oh, Soleimani needed to get killed.
Yeah.
Right? No. The people who need to get out of there or get killed is the United States.
Mm-hmm.
That's what has to happen. There isn't a disagreement at the top of society, in our ruling class, about this, something like this needing to happen.
I mean, there are maybe a few dissenting voices that, by and large, the response is unanimous, and it's the only difference is, how, mm-hmm. and, or the BS about legality, right. and constitutionality, right. even though it's non-existent. But
even recently killing 1,500 people at the many protests that are taking place all throughout Iran. The very defective JCPOA expires shortly anyway and gives Iran a clear and quick path to nuclear breakout. Iran must abandon its nuclear ambitions and end its support for terrorism.
And again, he's saying that and he is threatening them but you have to understand that the only sensible response of the Iran ruling class to all this thing that the U.S. is doing is get yourself a nuclear weapon as soon as possible. And that was true whether it was Obama's little, what he's calling appeasement strategy, or whether it's this thing. that was set in motion the minute the U.S. went into Iraq.
The time has come for the United Kingdom, Germany, France, Russia, and China to recognize this reality. They must now break away from the remnants of the Iran deal, or JCPOA. And we must all work together toward making a deal with Iran that makes the world a safer and more peaceful place. We must.
So, what do you think about what he said there about the NATO?
I don't know.
I'll just say this. So first off, the idea that Russia and China should join in and be like, oh, help us take down Iran, that's crazy. It's like Russia attacking Israel and saying, hey, United States, come and help us go after Israel, your proxy in the region. They know that, all right? So this, again, this attack on Iran is an attack on Russia. It is a message to China. It is basically U.S., in a sense, beginning the process of declaring war on them because, again, they've already, in their own strategic defense initiatives, indicated that they see the war on terror as something of the past, and the wars of the future are going to be big wars between big powers, China and Russia.
Who said that?
The United States. Okay. The defense and their recent defense budgets have been, and it was written by Mad Dog Mattis, back in the day when he wrote his defense strategy. But that is the new strategy that this regime has been running under, has been moving towards a defense posture, that a national defense posture, which is really just a military posture of preparing for wars with Russia and China. But he did mention Germany, France, and Britain, right? And the U.S. went it alone, right? This is the U.S. going alone, and now they're saying NATO has to come back involved. But the interesting thing is here, NATO actually has made a response to this. Do you know some of the things they said?
Basically, I think we talked about it, about Iran, toning it down,
So here's
not escalating.
I'm going to read directly from some of the... This is the response that NATO had towards the United States murdering and assassinating another leader in the region, Iran, Soleimani. We have condemned, this is a statement written by Britain, France, and Germany, and maybe others. They said, we have condemned the recent attacks on coalition forces in Iraq and are gravely concerned by the negative role Iran has played in the region, including through the Iran Revolutionary Guard and the Al-Quds force under command of General Soleimani. So they condemn General Soleimani, that in their statement, right? Then they also say, we call on all parties to exercise utmost restraint and responsibility. The current cycle of violence in Iraq must be stopped. And then they go further and say, we specifically call on Iran to refrain from further violent action or proliferation and urge Iran to reverse all measures inconsistent with what Trump just mentioned, the JCPOA, Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, this nuclear accord. So essentially, what these NATO powers have done, when the U.S. went in alone and said, screw you, Europe, we're going to do whatever we want, what did the NATO powers do? They basically said, they gave up. They offered no resistance to Trump, no resistance to the United States, and have basically blamed the victim for being attacked, all right? And far from it condemning the killing of General Soleimani, they condemn the violence that they say he caused. So they've come in completely behind the United States. Yeah. And again, this is the most craven ruling class response I can imagine coming from Germany, France, and Britain. And it's kind of disgusting, actually. And I find it like, I was talking to Brian and he was like, well, what do you expect? I actually expected when the U.S. so basically gave them the middle finger and said, we're going it alone, I expected them to put up a little bit of like, now we're going to go over here with Russia and basically talk with them about what we can do to keep you in a box. But no, what do? They gave the United States the green light, not only for the action they took, but for going into further action. Yeah. And we're going to blame Iran. If Iran even thinks about getting a nuclear weapon to defend itself, well, then we're going to justify an Israeli attack on them or a U.S. direct attack on them with bunker busters or whatever. So this is a replay of appeasement. of appeasement of like Hitler back in the day. This is a replay of a replay of the European powers finding another dictator that they are afraid of, and basically not knowing, wanting to appease him. And that's what the United States, that's what these European powers are doing with the United States. Trump ain't a dictator, but the U.S. ruling class is a freight train of violence, a freight train of criminality, and an imperial war, and the British and the French and the Germans are literally sucking up right behind them and giving them a green light to doing more.
What do you think they want to get out of that?
I think it's the same old thing. I think what they're hoping is if Iran just lays, if they can side with you with the big bully and get Iran to just lay low, maybe they can get their shit together to eventually be in a position where they can be, as a European Union, a power that can compete with the United States or China or that. Because right now their shit's cracking up.
Yeah.
So I think, that's the only thing I can think, because there's nothing to be gained here because the U.S. doesn't give a shit about them.
Yeah.
And it's going to use their region is going to be a theater of the U.S. war. That's the only thing that the U.S. knows. The U.S. is already talking about using tactical nuclear weapons. Do you think those weapons are going to be used in Canada?
Yeah.
They're going to be used on the border of Russia and Europe. And their region is going to become the theater of that war. So all they're doing is saying, please irradiate our countries with nuclear weapons in 15 years by appeasing the United States.
We must also make a deal that allows Iran to thrive and prosper and take advantage of its enormous untapped potential. Iran can be a great country. Peace and stability cannot prevail in the Middle East as long as Iran continues to foment violence, unrest, hatred, and war.
Never mind Saudi Arabia, is what I think. Right. I mean, because they're our allies, and everything that he's accusing Iran of doing, Saudi Arabia does,
Actually does,
yeah.
And it's doing it within Yemen.
Yeah, and the U.S. has supported that, and, some of the most, I'm using the language of the deep state, but, some of the most extremist forms of Islam come out of Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the terrorists, quote unquote, that run into the, towers.
Saudi Arabian.
I mean, Osama bin Laden.
Think that's how it went down.
Yeah, Osama bin Laden was from Saudi Arabia, and, yet we have a very, and what's his name? The current king of Saudi Arabia?
Oh, bin Salman.
Yeah. And, he's also something else,
Yeah,
right?
With his murder of Jamal Khashoggi. And basically, look, again, these are all third-rate torturers, third-rate violent criminals when you talk about Netanyahu or bin Salman. The top ones are the United States. But the United States is in league with some pretty thuggish characters.
And buying into the... this idea that it's only like Muslim, the torture, the U.S. does it all the time.
Yes.
The torture and, people into submission, commit atrocities,
Right. And we were talking about this before, and I think I'll make this point now. The U.S. makes such a thing about ISIS and these spectacles of beheadings. Yeah. What do you think what they just did with Soleimani is? This is spectacle writ large.
No.
This is how the U.S. ruling class does beheadings. It takes you down and says it's taking you down, and then says, we'll do it to any one of you. So what you are watching here, folks, is a giant video message by the U.S. ruling class saying, we can cut any of your heads off.
Yeah.
So if you think that those people with their little hand cams are your problem, then you're not understanding what you're watching on the television. Because those people that you're watching on the television, those are the people who you got to worry about. Those are the people with the giant, scimitars ready to chop off your heads, and they can get you anywhere.
And again, the point you made earlier that, these people that are dying or they're, occupiers, they know they're going into the hot,
yes.
place.
Yep.
The civilized world must send a clear and unified message to the Iranian regime. Your campaign of terror, murder, mayhem will not be tolerated any longer.
First of all, he's stumbling over his words. I don't know if we have to say anything here.
It bothers me, you know, because I remember when Trump first came into office, or even prior to his election, you know, a lot of people were dismissing him as this fool, you know, this, right. You know, and they were focused, a lot of the criticism of the left were focusing on character, you know, defamation or assassination, dismissing, you know, what's behind. And, you know, like the Kofafi.
Right.
And I was so furious because there was real shit happening in the background.
Yes.
You know, and a lot of the left was playing this childish game of mocking this, you know.
You're right.
Yeah. So, so I'm wondering if this will get some play around, you know.
And I fell for it a little bit, you know, like, and I get caught up in, you're absolutely right, though. That's horse shit.
Because.
And it keeps you from actually seeing what you're dealing with.
You know, it brings me back to, like, a lot of sources of the left news, you know, or at least liberal left, you know, like The Daily Show or, you know, what's his name?
Steve Colbert.
Steve Colbert and what's the other guy on HBO, British?
John Oliver.
Okay. Yeah, you know, and, like, they lightly touch on some of the things. And sometimes... Actually, very often, they advance a lot of the narratives that are coming from these, you know, from the state, you know, from the FBI, CIA, the Washington. A lot of, you know, like in Venezuela, you know, there's an episode of John Oliver talking about Venezuela and just patronizing Venezuela, patronizing people, you know, and buying the, you know, the issue in Venezuela is mismanagement from the government, you know, and... Like, yeah, you gotta be crazy to think that any government wants to starve their people, you know, on purpose.
Yep.
I mean,
Well, no, I think it's a really good point.
It will not be allowed to go forward. Today, I am going to ask NATO to become much more involved in the Middle East process. Over the last 3 years, under my leadership, our economy is stronger than ever before, and America has achieved energy independence. These historic accomplishments change our strategic priorities. These are accomplishments that nobody thought were possible.
This is something you had pointed out in earlier episodes of What's Left about the U.S. doing fracking, and it's now essentially made itself oil independent.
Yeah, 90% of the energy we consume is produced within the U.S.
Right.
It includes a lot of natural gas, which was sold by Obama to be a greener, or at least a step into the, you know, the green revolution direction. Even though a lot of, you know, the use of gas is also, you know, it's a big polluter as much as, you know. And even the process of just extracting the gas, fracking, you know, is highly toxic, you know, and dangerous. And, you know, we've had incidents in California, you know, where, like, there's been, like, pipes rupturing and, you know, contaminating. So, yeah, I mean, yes, you know, there was this maybe a slight difference there, like Obama, you know, redirecting, you know, the U.S. Obama sold, you know, this oil independence or whatever, energy independence, sold it as a green project when in reality it's an imperial project.
That's correct. Very good. Yeah. And the question then is, why is, because I do think the U.S. is planning on staying in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
So why is the U.S. staying in the Middle East if they are oil independent? Because they ain't leaving. I'm more convinced of this now as I see what they're doing.
I mean, I think I've made this point in the past. Yeah. To me, it's again destabilizing possible competitors, because there is, you know, it's not just about extraction. There is business, there's profit to be made, and so destabilizing, you know, in Iran does play into, you know, markets and stuff. But not only that, but you want to have, you know, control. You know, if you're the dictator of the world,
right? And anybody who's done any of these kind of war games, Axis and Allies is when I used to play back in the day, or Risk even, but you, with games that are more detailed, you know if you can control their resources. You know what one of the ways of defeating your opponents that you plan on fighting in war is not to direct fight them directly, but you want to control a an area that they need for a valuable resource, like oil. So China is directly in the crosshairs of U.S. When the U.S. controls Middle Eastern oil, that is definitely something, that's a message sent to China to say, we can bring you down, not necessarily militarily at this point, but we can bring your economy to a halt by virtue of our ability to control your access to that oil in that region. So the reason the U.S. needs to stay there, even if they get oil independent, is because they plan on fighting the powers that do rely on that oil. And Europe, Russia, well, Russia doesn't so much, but in China.
There's a little update, I think it's relevant to this. Guaido. In Venezuela, I don't know if you noticed, that he stormed into the Venezuelan Congress and was sworn in symbolically with no electricity. But it happened at the same time this was happening in Iran. But it again, you know, it's the U.S. Understanding the geopolitical implications of, you know, having influence in either controlling or destabilizing these two big sources of oil for, you know, because Venezuela could potentially just, you know, do business with China and Russia and... But for the meantime, just keep it a mess.
Which is why maintaining the Monroe Doctrine and U.S. control of South America has been so important. You can't let China come in through the back door and get control, get access to oil when they're trying, when the U.S. is trying to control them.
And Evo Morales is gone. Lula da Silva is gone. You know, Hugo Chavez is gone. So
options in the Middle East became available. We are now the number one producer of oil and natural gas anywhere in the world. We are independent, and we do not need Middle East oil. The American military has been completely rebuilt under my administration at a cost of $2.5 trillion.
It just throws it out there.
Right, like, it is something that Trump can feel confident that he can say a number like $2.5 trillion being spent on the military over a three-year period, and not think that the U.S. population would come and take him out of the office and put him in chains.
What's the size of the U.S. economy? Like 13 trillion or 14 trillion?
I don't know what, these numbers are on order with the size of our entire economy. And it shows us the state of the anti-war movement in this country, that a president can feel confident to say a number like that when we have the level of poverty we have, when we have the level of homelessness, the gentrification that's going on, what's happening to our schools.
Healthcare.
And having... 2.3 million people in prison over largely crimes committed out of poverty. So it's I mean, it shows that the one of the reasons the U.S. ruling class is so powerful is the degree to which they have smashed and captured the hearts and minds of the American ruling working class. Not that people are so happy, but the fact that we are caught up in this Republican-Democrat game.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't know if it was you or someone else, I don't know where, but one of the things that sticks with me is that, you know, an empire can go to war to the degree that they can control their own population.
Yep.
You know, and so we are very subdued. There is little to no resistance.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that, so I'll take responsibility.
All right, sure. Lipson's quote.
U.S. armed forces are stronger than ever before. Our missiles are big, powerful, accurate, lethal, and fast.
He's just flaunting his cars now.
Yes, yes. And the stronger the U.S. military to make war on our brothers and sisters across the globe, then that means the weaker our situation as the working class is in this country. So that it's a complete, we should understand this as completely inverted. That what they celebrate as our as so-called U.S. strength of our military actually is a celebration of the ruling class over the working class here. Because for us as workers, every time they're able to get away with strengthening the workers to go fight foreign wars and kill workers abroad, that just means how weak our own cause is here. The other indicator is open borders, right? The degree to which people say, oh, we gotta protect our borders and like that. Yeah. We need open borders. Workers, the U.S. working class needs open borders to actually have a chance of having a revolution. So this is another one of those indicators of how weak our situation is as a working class, is the degree to which the U.S. ruling class is able to celebrate They're massive military built on destruction and really built on our money, on our blood, and with the aim of using our blood to get more money for themselves and more resources for themselves at our expense and at the expense of our fellow workers across the globe. So
this is just,
Under construction are many hypersonic missiles. The fact that we have this great...
You know what hypersonic missiles are?
Is this the space thing?
No, apparently Russia has, and China has built... hypersonic just means it can go many times faster than the speed of sound. Right? Yeah. And so they're harder to shoot down. Mm-hmm. And so this is what happened. The minute the U.S. has been built, the U.S. has been constructing a missile defense.
Yeah.
And so what happens, the minute you construct missile defense, is what the Will said, is U.S. construction of missile defense is completely for the act of war making. Because what it forces the other side to do is to, in order to be able to defend itself, it has to penetrate that missile defense. So this is why the Russians and others are building faster weapons, faster missiles, to get through there so they can't be shot down. Now the United States is saying, well, we're going to go and build them ourselves.
Faster, faster cars.
Yeah, yeah. So, and I've been actually giving, I give out a paper written about these, what's something called the scramjet, which is a prototype for hypersonic planes, basically, that are able to go at Mach 10, mm-hmm. 10 times the speed of sound. And they are sold in the article as something, well, eventually you can have commercial travel where you can go from the United States, you can go from San Francisco to New York, and you can get there in 25 minutes. I mean, you could, theoretically, you can get there in 25 minutes. It's like, that's like going from San Francisco to LA. But that ain't what these things are about.
No.
It's not about commercial travel. None of this stuff. Just like nuclear power is not about trying to get us more energy.
Yeah, I mean, commercial travel hasn't changed. That's another topic, but it hasn't really changed fundamentally.
And that's not the reason these hypersonic things are being built.
Yeah.
You know, they're being built for exactly this, so they can kill it. We can kill each other.
Do you think this has, does, you know, SpaceX and all these private ventures have anything to do with this?
I do. I'm not entirely sure how I see it all. I mean, part of me just wonders if the U.S. ruling class is just saying, we got to get the F off this planet and let the whole thing, because we're going to burn this whole thing up anyway. We've got to have a place to go. So I've heard that kind of thing. I don't think it's crazy, you know. And I've heard there's bunkers being built in New Zealand and shit like that. So,
sure.
You know, but it is not about Star Trek and space utopia.
No.
It is about the U.S. ruling class having to have a plan B once they make this place a cinder and humans can't live there. Because trust me, the people on getting on those ships to get out,
it's you and me.
It's going to be you and me.
We have this great military and equipment, however, does not mean we have to use it.
It does.
We do not want to use it. American strength, both military and economic, is the best deterrent. 3 months ago, after destroying 100% of ISIS and its territorial caliphate, we killed the savage leader of ISIS, al-Baghdadi, who was responsible for so much death, including the mass beheadings of Christians, Muslims, and all who stood in his way.
Again, folks, the level of violence he's talking about from Baghdadi or ISIS is minuscule compared to what the United States has done in that region, let alone around the globe.
Yeah.
It's nothing. So this guy is able to talk about somebody who is like 3,056 on the violence death chart, and he's up there number one, number two. You know, so I don't think 3,056 is too high for people like Baghdadi or whoever. So it's completely inverted. The actual violence, the actual terrorists are the ones we're listening to here.
He was a monster. Al-Baghdadi was trying again to rebuild the ISIS caliphate and failed. Tens of thousands of ISIS fighters have been killed or captured during my administration. ISIS is a natural enemy of Iran. The destruction of ISIS is good for Iran, and we should work together on this and other shared priorities.
And this is, I think when I first heard him say this, I did start to think that he was trying to make some sort of appeal within forces within Iran to that, like, crack up. This is where I got into this notion of, like, what are they getting at? He's just literally killed one of their top guys, and now he's making an appeal. Either, I don't know what that's about, but I just thought that there must be some belief that that the pressure they're putting the Iranian ruling class under is going to create cracks that allow some section to say, we're cutting you loose, and we're heading back towards the West somehow. I don't know.
Finally, to the people and leaders of Iran, we want you to have a future, and a great future, one that you deserve, one of prosperity at home and harmony with the nations of the world. The United States is ready to embrace peace with all who seek it. I want to thank you, and God bless America. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.
Is this the most presidential speech he's ever given?
I don't know. I don't listen to a lot of what he says. I'm inexperienced listening to this guy.
But I mean, he usually like seems to go off the script, you know, like, or, like with some, you know what I mean, like.
Yeah, this was. He did not go off the script here. Yeah.
And you know, and that's what I mean. Like he stayed very presidential.
See, and people use that term presidential, and they think our own country, and people even on the left or liberals want to say, "Oh, do you understand that all these people who are being presidential are doing are fooling you into seeing that they are not the most criminal, violent, monstrous gangsters on the globe." So what you're saying is, please lie. When you want somebody to be presidential, what you are saying is, please lie to me. Please tell me a lie that I can at least believe, so I can believe that the people who run my country are not the biggest criminal, monster, gangsters on the globe.
Yeah.
So what you're getting to see is somebody who is showing you that that's not. It has never been the case. It wasn't under Obama. It wasn't true under Clinton. It wasn't true under FDR. It was has never been true. The U.S. ruling class is a bunch of monsters. And if you want them to be presidential, what you're asking is, can the monster please put on a sweet little mask so that I'm no longer frightened by it by looking at it? And it's ridiculous. These monsters have to be taken down.
They do. I mean, like, I don't know, I posted a lot of stuff on Instagram and whatever, but one of the things is that I'm still waiting for a convincing argument to tell me that Obama was better than this guy. You know, and if anything, you see a linear, you know, progression of between the classes, you know.
A continuity of policy continuity. In many ways, and a shift once ISIS is out, now we shift.
You know, one of the biggest, like, topics, maybe it departs from a little bit from this, but it's this whole notion that Obama, because maybe he was a man of color, wasn't racist. You know, he didn't engage in racist policies. You know, but when we look at it even to this day, like, actually Trump has not deported as many people as Obama.
That's correct.
You know, Clinton, another, you know, champion of liberalism.
Yes.
You know, he made war on the working class, you know, Mexican working class, U.S. working class, built walls, you know, and he started the whole, you know, like stopping the immigration by deterrence, right? Like pushing people into more dangerous areas.
Right.
And so
there's more people would die coming.
Yeah. And so there's been continuity from Clinton to Bush to Obama to Trump. You know, there is little, you know, opposition to the, you know, the building empire.
Yeah. And anyone who tells you anything about trying to go into the Democratic Party to resuscitate it, to change it, anybody who's telling you that there's a way to do that, they're either your enemy or a fool, and they should not be listened to.
That's reformism, believing that you can change the system and
Among that two criminal. Look, I'll understand people say Green Party or what have you. I get it. That's not going to happen that way. But anybody who believes that there's a way through the Democratic Party or Republican Party, these gangsters.
Yeah.
And you're saying, oh, but Bernie Sanders, Ocasio-Cortez, those are people who put lipstick on the gangster post, all right? Those people are your opponents. Yeah. So,
and that's not socialism.
Yes, and unfortunately, that's where the left is, and it's sad. And they think it's the only game in town because it seems to be the biggest game in town, but there's nothing there. It is the biggest boondoggle of the left that there's something to be built there. And it's sad, and it's one of the, another reason why What's Left exists. So that's it here?
I think so.
I think, I think this worked.
Yeah.
I think, we'll see.
We'll see well, if you get the technical aspects of it.
Yes, I have some work to do now for the editing. But, well, thank you, Kenny.
Thank you.
I appreciate you doing this. Maybe we'll do this again. I kind of feel like you should be here for our episode when Eduardo comes back.
Me?
Yeah.
I should be?
I do. Okay. I feel like that.
I'll grill that guy.
No. I mean, I want to hear what happened in France.
I do too.
They've been going on strike for almost 2 months now. You know, it's a big deal. So I'll talk to Eduardo.
Ooh, there is another. I mean, I don't know if maybe a future topic, but like over 250 million people went on strike in India.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So. And another one is I have a former, you know, comrade that I worked with in the ISO, and he's in Australia. So I also want to get a report from him. I was thinking about reaching out to him. Yeah.
Wasn't he a fire?
He did actually try to get a job in the fire. Among firemen, the forest rangers or something like that. I don't think he's doing that, but I think he did dabble in that a little bit. So anyway, we got some things to figure out in the future, but you know, hopefully we can stay out of war with the rest of the world until then. Thank you for joining us. Hope you enjoyed this. Leave any comments or likes that you have. You can find this episode on iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher, Google Play, and BitChute. Rate or review us, subscribe on YouTube or iTunes or whatever. That will help us as well. And hopefully we'll see you next week.
Yeah.
And maybe with Kenny, or we'll see. You get used to seeing either me, Kenny, or Eduardo in any of these episodes. We're going to start to become interchangeable.
All right, cool.
All right. All right, see you next week.
See you next week.
Finally, some analysts suggest that the impeachment of President Trump has emboldened enemies like Iran and North Korea to think that they can confront him. Do you think that, as misguided as it may be, that some of our enemies think that this president is more vulnerable because of the impeachment effort?
You should ask Mr. Soleimani.